You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
8 minutes after 10. Thank you so much for staying with us. Well, let me not be presumptuous. If you've just joined us, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. The second hour of the Eusebius McKayser Show. I don't know about you, but I would like to be able to speak in a more confident, literate manner about finance in general, and in particular about this currency trading competition commission. And many of us, as I was just saying to one of my guests, have got strong intuitions, dare I say it, even strong convictions about what is going on in the finance sector currently in relation to currency trading, and yet we actually don't understand the nitty-gritty. So see the next hour as a sort of idiot's guide to currency trading. How could they have done it? Did they do anything wrong? And hopefully we will graduate from standard grade to higher grade questions closer to 11 o'clock when we also chat to other folks like Stuart Theobald, who wrote a skeptical blog entry for Intellidex in which he said, well, you know what? Actually, it may be hard to go after these guys, even if they did something wrong. And I'm not sure whether, in fact, the impact of what they could have done with a couple of conversations is quite as huge as many of you who are moralizing imagine it to be. So we will start very slowly with the basics. And whatever questions you have, please do call in. I've got a couple of expert guests who will help us to navigate some of this stuff. 011-883-0702 is our Johannesburg number, and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. And let me welcome them into the studio. Firstly, Gary Boyson, who is a trader. He tells me that he is ethical and very transparent, apparently. Market commentator as well, and portfolio manager at Rand Swiss. Gary, thank you so much for taking time out and joining us in the studio.
Very good to be here. Hello to the listeners.
And of course, you know, as I'm a big fan of his work, Rob Rose, Deputy Editor of Financial Mail. You'll struggle to find anyone writing more lucidly about finance than Rob does. Rob, thanks so much for coming into studio.
Great to be here, but that's far too generous, as you'll soon see.
And he's humble as well. And don't be fooled by that voice. He's got a big, big brain. And an interesting cover story as well, eh, that went to bed quite late. Just describe it to us. I'll take a picture of it in a second.
I suppose, you know, obviously it was the budget week, so we focused on the budget. But the main magazine was about the digging into the cowboy capitalists who tried to rig the rand and what it actually meant, how it worked, pretty much like your dummy's guide to currency trading, what actually happened in this case, and looking at whether, like you say, it's a systemic issue with the banks or just certain individuals.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, this is quite interesting, and I want to slow down the conversation immediately, Gary. Currency trading, what is currency trading?
So if you look at currency trading, I suppose there's many different levels of currency trading. So you get, you know, I think it's important to make the distinction between institutional trading, which is really the wholesale bank trading, and retail trading, which is a lot of the time that's the speculation. It's what the public is exposed to. And also, I suppose when someone wants to go overseas, they need to buy or sell currency, and they go to a currency outlet and they actually have to, you know, go and exchange rands for dollars. So essentially all currency trading really is taking one currency and converting it to another currency.
Okay, so I'm going to the States, I've got rands, and I buy US dollars.
Correct. Yeah. That there you've just performed a currency trade. Now, obviously, depending on how you trade, you know, it comes all sorts of different pricing models, all sorts of different fees that people face. And obviously, with different sizes, you know, once you start moving into the institutional market, you start facing things like liquidity constraints. And then I suppose Rob will talk a little bit more about how they can manipulate currencies. But essentially,
so why do banks trade currencies with each other? Because I understand if I want to go on a little holiday for 3 weeks, I need a different currency that I get. I find myself at our Tambo, I'm busy buying currency. Practically, that makes complete sense to me.
Yeah, so there's all different reasons why a bank would trade currency. So, and I mean, there's all different ways that a bank trades currencies. I mean, I don't want to get it too technical since this is Forex 101, so we don't want to talk about swaps and forwards and all of that. But essentially, I suppose, you know, the big market participants is banks would help customers either hedge positions if you're an importer or an exporter and you want to, you know, create a contract to try and fix your price of currency. Not in the ominous sense of price fixing, but to say I need a rand dollar exchange rate at this level because I'm going to import this many cars from Korea, and I need to fix a price so that I can plan my budgeting. So that's the one reason that banks would service clients. The other is, you know, the pure retail. I mean, we need to transfer money to an offshore portfolio, and then again, I mean, they also service the whole financial system works through a system of pooling and netting. So when I have currency trades that I have clients coming to us and they want to buy and sell different currencies, we'll take all our currency currency trades, roll them up and pass them up to a bank. The bank will then act as the wholesaler, whereas we're the retailer. So that's another way their currency trading works. And it's also to I suppose, balance off their currency exposures depending on a myriad of transactions. And it's everything from corporate finance deals all the way across the board. So there's many, many reasons why banks trade currencies. It is the largest market in the world after the credit market. And it's also decentralized. So there's no single exchange that currencies are trading on. It's very broad, and it's done what's called OTC. So a lot of it is over the counter, where it's one bank making an agreement with another bank to exchange currency flows.
Before we talk about the Cowboys, Rob, it does then sound, if I understand Gary correctly, that there is legitimate business here that can be done in terms of currency trading. It's not inherently murky.
Not inherently, but I think that there are a couple of things he mentioned. For example, the fact that you call a bank and the bank says to you, I'll give you this rate. There's no sort of central market that you can look online and say, everyone's seeing this price, so it's very clear price transparency. You call a bank, they give you a price. Within that, there's not great transparency. So it's the opportunity exists for people to arbitrage that kind of the lack of murk, the lack of clarity to make extra money for themselves. But like you said, it's a $5.2 trillion market per day, I think, or something ridiculous. So there's just tons of money in it. There's immense amounts. And, you'd have to believe that a large part of that is essentially not corrupt. You'd want to believe that.
Gary, I can see you signaling there. You were gesticulating when you talked about the murk.
No, but it's very interesting. I think Rob's 100% right. With the bank market, I mean, the way that, banks will make money. There's really two ways that you can make money off a currency trade as a trader, as a supplier of a trade, to either as a wholesaler to a retailer like me, or for me to trade with my counterparty being the retail public. You can either charge a commission on your trade. So you can either say, if you want to go and buy Rand at 13 Rand to the dollar, that's fine. We'll give it to you at the spot rate. So the spot rate is kind of where the natural market is trading at the moment. And then I'll charge you a fee for doing that. The other way is, like Rob says, and where it becomes very murky, is that you start to widen your spread. So if you go and look at, one of the boards at the airport, and it says, we buy currency at this level, we sell currency at that level, the spread is essentially the difference between the buy and the sell price. Now, if you look at those boards, I suppose trader terminology, you can drive a bus through that spread because it is incredibly wide. I mean, if we look at a retail speculating trading platform, we talk in pips, which is, if you quote Rand dollar, for example, to four decimal places, that last decimal place is a pip. So our fee on retail speculatory trading is one pip. I mean, it is so tight. I mean, we can give euro dollar trades literally at no spread, but then obviously a commission markup after that. So you look at where some guys are charging 22 cents on the rand, and they'll have a big sign sitting above their board that says no commission, we don't charge anything, and yet they're charging you 22 cents on your trade. It is very, very significant. I mean, again, we do a lot of offshore transfers for clients as well. Obviously, with the loosening of exchange controls, you can move up to 10 million rand offshore just with a tax clearance. But if you're moving 10 million rand offshore and your bank is now quoting you a rate, and they're charging you, let's say, it's very difficult because you've also got the liquidity in the spread as well. But if they're quoting your rate, I mean, they can take up to 300,000 rand commission on a 10 million rand trade without actually saying we're charging any commission, just by opening up the spread. And I mean, we've had this situation where we obviously get wholesale rates off the bank. We're kind of used to dealing with the banks at a certain rate. A client phones us and says, I've already got an account with this bank. Can you just organize the transaction with a currency desk? And you phone through to the currency desk, and you say, okay, and you're sort of expecting to get quoted your same rate. We're obviously looking on screen. We can see the exact spot rate. And we're kind of used to, like, on an FX transfer, it's about, typically we would be looking at about 8 cents markup on that. And they mark up sort of 20 cents on the client. You said, but why are you twice as expensive as you normally are? And then the immediate response is, oh, it's the liquidity in the market, which is rubbish.
Surely the right answer is because we can.
Yeah, because we can. Because we can. And then, I suppose a client that wasn't aware of the situation will go to their bank and they'll ask for a rate. And we've had it. Oh, well, I'll get to the bank because they're not going to charge me anything. Yeah. And we said, but what rate did they give you? Oh, no, it was a pretty good rate. We got 13.11. And then you sort of go and look at the time the trade went through and you say, the market was actually trading at 12.90 at that stage and you just got ripped 300,000, but you're so happy because you think you haven't paid anything. So, I mean, it definitely happens. And I mean, I would say, Yeah, like I said, Financial Mail Stockbroker Awards, we were rated the most transparent broker. I have no problem just ripping the lid off this and showing the dirty laundry underneath.
Okay, it's 18 minutes after 10. If you've got a question, you can put it to Gary. He will explain it to you. He is a trader on 011-883-0702 and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. And even with my BA degree, I'm following most of what he is saying. In case you prefer hearing it from an American woman, this is what she sounds like.
How do you make money trading money? Making money in the foreign exchange market is a speculative process. You are betting that the value of one currency will increase relative to another. Currencies are traded and priced in pairs. Take a quote for a euro to US dollar pair of 1.2131. The base currency is the euro and it's worth one unit. The US dollar is the quote currency, which is the amount that one unit of the base currency can buy. In this example, one euro can buy 1.2131 US dollars. Investors make money through the appreciation of the quoted currency or a decrease in the base currency. Another way to look at it is to think of the base currency as a short position. You are selling the base currency, or the euro, to buy the quoted currency, or the long position. 1 euro can buy 1.2131 US dollars. To make money, the investor must sell the euro when its value appreciates relative to the US dollar. Assume the euro appreciates to 1.2141 US dollars. On a lot of $100,000, the investor gains $100. That's an increase to $121,410 from $121,310.
Minutes after 10, guys, put on your headphones. Before we talk about the Cowboys, let's take some calls as well. 011-883-0702. You can ask whatever you want. And in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Let's go to Simonstown. Martin, good morning and welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to just know where the newspapers get the rates from that they quote in the paper daily. Who tells them what the rate is?
I don't know. You guys know?
I'm also not sure exactly. I suppose different newspapers would get different quotes, but I'm not sure. They might also quote the spot rate. I haven't actually looked at a currency, to be honest, in a newspaper for a long time.
I think one of the issues is that there's a fix in London at 4 o'clock. Well, that gives you kind of a benchmark rate that the kind of lot of newspapers use. But it is essentially a commodity that's traded virtually the entire day, 24 hours. So it's difficult to say because it's moving the whole time. But I think London does try give a sort of a benchmark at 4 p.m. every day so that the newspapers can use it and use it as sort of, you know, the basic idea that people should be dealing with.
Yeah, I suppose if you're not actually quoting a bit off a spread, you know, you can get a fairly accurate spot rate. Like I said, if you're looking at a euro-dollar pair, I mean, we can go down, you'll be within a pip, which is absolutely tight. So if they're quoting spot rates, they don't vary by much as well, because I think the manipulation would really go in the size of the spread that they were charging, I would assume. But again, if you're looking at the spot rates, as soon as spot rates move out more than, you know, like a couple of pips, The interbank arbitrage players will come in, and arbitrage is really the guys that are trying to make risk-free profits. So if you could buy rand dollar in one market and then sell rand dollar in another market at two different prices, there's a risk-free profit to be made. So that would immediately force the two prices back together. So the spot rates are pretty accurate, and they don't vary very much. It'll be a couple of points in the number.
Okay, so Rob, let's get to the heart of the issue then. What are the banks accused of?
Well, I mean, what's really interesting in this case is that it was part of a long 3-year, 4-year investigation done across the world. And in the States, a couple of the banks have pleaded guilty to this. I think paid a $2.5 billion fine, which is a lot of money. And I think 2 weeks ago, one of the guys named in this case in South Africa, Jason Katz, reached a plea bargain in the U.S. And agreed to help them in the investigation. So it's a wide, long-ranging thing. Now, what they did is, they manipulated the spreads, so they made more money. They said, "Well, you know, we'll sell at this amount, we'll buy at this amount." So they colluded to say, "You know, guys, let's all get together and let's all offer our clients this amount of spread." So, I mean, if you're in a competitive market, one bank and a client comes to you and says, I want to change this, and the rate's bad, the spread's bad, he'll go to another bank. But if the other bank's agreeing to also keep their rates at a certain level, it manipulates the demand, the supply and demand, and manipulates the actual value the clients get. That was one way. There were about four or five different ways in which the banks did it, allegedly, according to the court papers across the world. They also did front running. For example, I think in New York they would, which is a complicated term, it essentially means one trader will buy dollars potentially for himself if he knows there's a big order coming, knowing that the price will increase, and then he'll sell it back to the clients. So the guy's doing it for their own accounts, and the guy's doing it just to make certain trades and improve their bonuses, their own position. It's the trading world, and obviously Gary knows more about it, but it seems to be, in some cases, very laddish culture.
And please don't laugh if this is a stupid question. So are you saying basically that if, for example, my key performance indicator as a trader in Partly is a certain bonus I will get based on what I sell in terms of volume, if I can artificially ensure that we sell it at a certain kind of price, then obviously my bonus will be higher. Is that the motive for potential colluding?
Yeah, I mean, if you make more money on the trades, if you're making more profit for your division, you'll definitely get a higher bonus. I think it was Barclays in the UK that offered traders a 50% bonus based upon the increase in volumes they got, trading volumes. So with those kind of, I mean, it's basically sort of, you know, millions of pounds we're talking about. It's not sort of the small bonuses that, you know, we in the media might know about. It's actual bonuses.
You get a bonus at FM. Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. But Gary, I thought that you said, in fact, Rob mentioned it, that the number of traders who make daily decisions, the proverbial market, is so huge that presumably there isn't a room big enough to ensure efficient collusion, or not?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So the difference between, you know, it's the difference between the actual price of the currency, because price can mean a few things here. So what Rob was referring to there is the price of the spread. So you're saying, how wide is my spread going to be? And if we all get together and say, listen, we're not going to offer, you know, Forex transfers, you know, where we're actually taking currency out at anything less than this, and it doesn't matter if I go to Investec, Standard Bank, ABSA, I'm going to face the same price, and the best I can then do for clients as a retail provider is 8 cents to the clients, let's say. Yes, that would be a form of collusion, no doubt. But to actually manipulate the price of the currency by, you know, putting in big block orders and pushing the rand up 3 or 4 cents, so that you can make a different kind of profit. So there's two ways that a trader would make a profit for a bank. One is they get the volume through, so client flow. So they get an order, the order is for, you know, 100 million rand, and if they put that 100 million rand through, they make a percentage on that. So you could manipulate it, you know, if you had a number of different orders, you could manipulate it to push the price up a little bit to make sure all your orders triggered at certain prices. Pushing up the volume of sales that you essentially did for the day. That obviously makes more money for the bank, and I'm sure your bonus would get proportionally larger as well. The other way of making money is what's called proprietary trading as well, which is what Rob's talking about, front running. So there what would happen is, if I have the ability, if I have a big client order, you know, maybe, and I mean, this happened, well, I suppose in the LIBOR scandal was the first method, which was really, if let's say that we're talking about something, you know, that's trading at 100 Rand. I've got a big order, you know, let's say JP Morgan has a big order to sell at 101 Rand. I've got a big order to buy at 99 Rand. We kind of want the price to hit 101 Rand and 99 Rand, so both orders will full, so that we can get maximum volume through and make maximum commission. That was kind of what was happening in the LIBOR scandal. But what's happening, the other way to make it is the front running, which is prop trading. Now, if you know that you've got a, you know, let's say a billion rand order that you have to put through the market, and that's going to move the currency 8 or 9 cents, as Rob says, you can take a position ahead of that and say, well, I'll, you know, buy in at, you know, 13 Rand. I'll wait until my order, literally, that I know is going to go through the market, pushes it up to 13 Rand 09. Mm. And then I'll take my small order and just sell it back to my own clients, making a risk-free profit again. Mm. That, I think, is far more difficult in the currency market just because of the size. So if you look at the daily volume on the South African Rand, you're talking about $49 billion.
Wow.
Which makes up about 1% of the international currency market. So it's very, very large. Again, you look at the names of the banks on the list, though, and I mean, you know, again, through the system of pooling and netting, you know, it is conceivable that these banks, even in a decentralized system, had enough clout to move prices and then make those risk-free, I suppose.
Gary, we're going to lose you in a second, sadly, so let's put one question to you from one of our listeners in Kensington. David, hello, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I just want to know, are there any brokers or companies out there that will trade for the man in the street? So I would pay him 10, maybe 20,000 rand. They would amalgamate that and trade on my behalf.
Okay, so what you're talking about there is very much, you know, speculative forex trading, which is a completely, I suppose, different side of the forex market. And now this has become an incredibly popular thing for retail clients, and it's essentially, I suppose, it's highly speculative, and it's the casino side of the market. It's the side that you're not trying to, you know, hedge out a currency movement, or you're not trying to, you know, ensure that you know, when you import something that you're going to get an accurate price. Instead, what you're doing is you're trying to say, if the rand's at 13, I think it's going to go to 13.50. Can I place a bet on the rand essentially to go to 13.50, and then I can make profit? The problem is this isn't risk free. This isn't manipulating the market. This is very much speculation. And you know, in my experience, the currency market is a very, very difficult market to call in that way. We don't trade on behalf of clients. We can give clients the facilities to trade currencies, but we wouldn't advise them, you know, where to buy and sell, and whether you can then generate almost like a hedge fund style return off those assets. A lot of people do advertise that. There's a lot of brokers, especially that sit out of Cyprus. I would really advise that that people are very cautious when approaching them. I mean, we've had all sorts of horror stories of clients coming to us and not being able to get their money out. The regulation is a lot less stringent than it is in South Africa. The FSB is a very solid institution that protects the South African, financial market consumer to a large degree. And a lot of the offshore forex providers, which I suppose give you access into the liquidity, don't provide that. There's all sorts, and this is another discussion which we'll have to probably come back to, but I mean the difference between b-booking a client and straight through processing in that market, where essentially you'll put money in an account and the broker will literally take the opposite side of your trades. They see your deposit as income just about.
Sure.
They don't even see it like that they're going to trade. They're going to take the money, they'll take the opposite, they kind of know that you're going to lose all your money. And if you by chance make money, they'll pay you back.
Mm-hmm.
And then straight through processing is the other side of it, where they actually give you direct access into a liquidity provider without taking the other side of the trade. So there's a lot of debate around that and the ethics around it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a much larger discussion than I suppose the banking discussion we're having now.
Gary, thank you so much for coming in. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
That's Gary Boyton, who's a trader and also a portfolio manager with Rand Swiss.
Eusebius is on Twitter at Eusebius.
Also joining us for this conversation now is Thembi Nkosi Bonakele, who, of course, is a commissioner with the Competition Commission. Thembi Nkosi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, and good morning to you and your listeners.
It is an absolute pleasure. And also on the line, I think he is in London, the chairperson of Intellidex, Stuart Theobald. Stuart, thanks so much for being part of the conversation. I appreciate it.
Hi, Eusebius. Good to be with you.
Thembi Nkosi, I want to start with you. There's a lot of listeners who are asking, where is the Competition Commission in this conversation? And they've got plenty of questions for you. I suppose at a high level, just to ask about accountability, this is a very important matter because it is important to hold different sectors accountable.
That's correct, Eusebius. It's very important that particularly people who play or corporations in this case who play such a significant role in our economy. I think a lot of people have been saying, you know, we put our monies in the banks, so it's important that there is trust that that things are being done properly.
Many of the banks that feature in this story are international. How does the Competition Tribunal's jurisdiction work?
Well, we have the competition authorities have a jurisdiction on activities that have an impact on the South African economy. So it doesn't matter where they take place, as long as they have an impact. So here, obviously, the impact is on the currency. And so that's how we found jurisdiction.
Okay, I don't know if that will satisfy a lawyer. If someone is sitting somewhere in the States, somewhere in the UK, next to Stuart there in London, what they do can impact us and our local economy here if they behave unethically, but how will you go after them legally?
Well, actually, the test is not difficult at all. I mean, we just need to find a link to South Africa, and the fact that if you are manipulating the trading of the South African currency. This is the currency that South Africans have in hand. So if it gets weak or stronger, because of your manipulation, then that's the impact.
Stuart, I want to bring you in here. And like I said at the beginning, I am a blank slate. So if I'm asking the wrong question, feel free to also redirect to the issues that you think are the most nexus ones. One of the things you mentioned in a blog entry that has traveled quite well on the Intellidex website is precisely this question of jurisdiction. Before we talk about what the impact of possible collusion could have been, because you were skeptical about the magnitude of it. On this jurisdiction question, will it be as relatively easy as Tamin Khosi is saying to go after any of the Cowboys?
Look, I don't know the law as well as Tamin Khosi does. He's the expert on this. But, you know, there are two questions that come to my mind. One is the simple matter of jurisdiction. So, as Tamin Khosi says, the Competition Act makes reference to activities that affect the Republic. But clearly that's quite meant to be narrowly construed. There's loads of things that happen around the world that affect the Republic. You know, the election of Donald Trump has affected South Africa. So it's not just about effect. There has to be some kind of clear causal chain that links right to activity within the country. And in these cases, and as your guests have very well explained earlier in your show, the manipulation that seems to have happened was fairly momentary, and it's not at all clear that there was any long-term effect on the currency. And it might have involved specific transactions, so between a client sitting in London and a bank sitting in London, and the mispricing happens between that bank and that client. And it's hard to see how that affects the currency generally and the particular level of the currency. But maybe Tamin Khosi has more insight. He has the evidence that they have at his fingertips. So that's the issue around jurisdiction. Then there's a practical issue. I'm not sure how you prosecute a bank that has no people in South Africa, no activities in South Africa, and no infrastructure in South Africa. And in the list of 17 banks that the Competition Commission has cited, there's only a handful of them that have any activities or assets or anything in the country. So from a practical level, maybe Tamin Khosi can explain just what kind of strategy they have, how you even get those banks to respond to the complaint.
Tamin Khosi, let's take those issues in turn. Firstly, the impact on the economy. By Stewart's reckoning, any naughty conversations between two unethical traders that may have happened very quickly could have had a minuscule impact on our economy. Do you share that view?
Well, Eusebius, we've not done that study at all. In fact, we don't have to. I mean, we can, because it's an interesting question. I mean, we could do that. But it's enough for us to find that there was collusion. In other words, an agreement to fix a price or trading conditions. Now, we also understand that, I mean, sometimes it was in the interest of traders, often in the short term, to either get the currency to be stronger or to be weak. So when one does that study, you would have to take that into account. So it's not a conspiracy to weaken the currency necessarily. It's about the commissions people make during these trades, and so the intention might be short term. I would accept that, and so I think it will have to be a fairly complicated study to try and link that to the value of the currency over a long period of time.
Okay, Rob, you wanted to jump in here on that point?
I think what Stuart and Tamin Khosi are saying is right, but I think because the market is so huge, $51 billion a day, the odds of actually permanently causing a big devaluation in the rand on any specific day are very small. But I mean, it's not as if the economy wasn't hurt by this. There's a class action in the States against a lot of these banks, and it's this, and there's tons of pension funds from all over the world who've been part of this, and their argument is that, you know, they changed currency at a you know, detrimental rate to them. Importers would have paid more for it. They would then charge their clients more, and has a sort of a knock-on value impact down the whole value chain. So, even if the rand wasn't devalued over a longer period, it certainly would have caused the economy harm. You could certainly make that argument. And then I think Tim and Corsi's point is correct, that ultimately the very act of collusion itself is what is being targeted, and that's that should be, the bank should be held to account for that.
In addition to that, Stuart, I saw you expressing virtual surprise at the amount of money that Citibank has agreed to pay as an administrative penalty, 69.5 million rand. And I was wondering whether you'd then recalibrate your initial blog entry, that perhaps the effect was minuscule, or that from a jurisdictional point of view, at any rate, or practically as you put it, it will be hard to go after some of these banks. 69.5 million rand penalty suggests that these guys themselves must know that they had real impact.
The Citibank settlement is sizable. We, you know, Citibank reports at a global level its financials, so one can't really see the financials for the South African operation on its own. So you can't figure out what as a percentage of turnover in South Africa that money amounts to. Maybe Tim Akosi knows.
4%, Stuart. I can add to that.
Go for it, Tim Akosi.
4%. That's 4% of their annual turnover.
Okay. And Tim, of course, is it the annual turnover of the whole branch in South Africa, or is it only the currency trading section of the branch?
It's the whole branch in South Africa.
Okay. So, I mean that's, you know, as I understand it, the competition standard refers to affected turnover. So when collusion happens, that collusion affects the pricing of a specific area of activities of a bank. And I think some of the initial headlines after the Competition Commission's announcement talked about billions and billions, because when you add up the turnovers of at least the three South African banks mentioned over 5 years and then take 10% of that, the number you come to is absolutely astronomical. But within a big bank, like, say, Standard Bank, which is one of those cited, the currency trading activity is going to be a fairly small part of the bank, and I think that's what would classify as affected turnover. And that 10% on that affected turnover is going to be significantly less than 10% of the entire turnover of the group over the last 5 years. But maybe, you know, Tim, of course, you could add a bit more on that, on whether it's the affected turnover specifically connected to currency trading that they look at.
What are the penalties potentially? Obviously, we don't want to be presumptuous here about guilt, but at least in theory, Tim Nkosi, what kind of punitive measures do banks that come out worse for wear face?
Well, firstly, it's important to say that it's an adjudicative process. So it's just like someone who gets charged and you go to court saying that you want maximum penalty of 10 years. Ultimately, the court will have to impose that sentence, and you can't really know. In this case, just as a rough guide, we have a cap of 10% on penalty, and it's important to say this. It doesn't refer to the affected turnover. In fact, all major jurisdictions in the world, including South Africa, go beyond the affected turnover. So the affected turnover is relevant as a consideration, but it's not the end of the discussion. So we would look, for an example, on the duration of the conduct. So we may look at the affected turnover, in this case, the turnover from trading, but we could multiply it by the number of years that the offences take place, as long as we don't breach the cap of the total turnover of the bank.
Okay, let's take a quick break. We've got a couple of callers who want to ask you guys questions, and then we'll move on to the next theme. Let's take a couple of your calls now. And Kimberly Kamu, good morning.
Good afternoon to you and the listeners. I'm very angry at these financial institutions, the thuggery that is happening. But more than anything else, I'm angry at the fact that they're going to be penalized ultimately, because I don't think anybody's going to go to jail. Why is half that money from the penalty not going to be taken to reduce debt that they are from the clients that they're already engaging business with? I'm not talking about businesses now in particular. I'm talking about individual people who've got car loans, home loans, study loans that are drowning in debt.
and they are constantly being harassed by the corrupt financial institutions. Because even if they are not found guilty for what's happening now, they are guilty of many atrocities, especially the ridiculous interest rates that are in place. I mean, you take a car for 300,000, after you've paid it back for the 5-6 year period, you've basically paid off double what that car is. Who makes up these ridiculous interest rates?
Okay, so the entire sector there, some questions beyond this particular issue. Moshere, welcome to the show.
Yes, you see, yes, anyway, yes. You see, yes, what triggered Citibank to come forward to the commission? And also, if you listen to Tembingos, last week he has been consistent saying that whatever the amount that they only charge them 10%. Now he's changing tune because you have some guests in the studio who are explaining the damage that really this dishonesty has caused. He's talking about agreement. It's corruption, dishonesty. If you you collude, that's dishonest. They are lenient on this guy. You see, that's the only thing to bring this to an end is for those who are being involved also to go to jail and punish them harshly, to pay more than that. That's the only way we can stop this.
Okay, so they must go to jail.
Of course.
Okay, let's take another view. Mike?
Hi, yes. And I'm actually on the same vein as you know, just called Nat. Like in Iceland, I mean, in 2008, that situation, those bankers went to jail. The banks were bailed out. Why is it in this instance they're still paying fines? As far as I remember, there was a the new law that if you're caught, you actually now levied a jail term.
Okay, so that's coming up quite a lot. This question of criminal liability rather than just fines. Ray in Centurion.
You see, yes. Yeah, in listening to all these discussions, right, to me, all these penalties will eventually lead in money, you know, flowing into the treasury. What happens to ordinary South Africans who exchange the currencies during this period? Are we also going to be considered for a refund?
Okay, very good question. Temenkosi, I think there are two questions that come out of all of those. They echoed on Twitter as well. Should the cowboys be jailed? And at any rate, when you do find them, what happens to that money?
You say it's banks. I can't call them cowboys.
I'm calling them cowboys. You can use your own words.
Okay. In terms of the Competition Act itself, it's going to be very hard because the provisions are new. They only came into effect last year. So this largely took place before the criminal provisions came into effect. But I think I should not jump the gun on this because the conduct, as we described it, if you read it carefully, it's possible that you may find all sorts of criminal offences emanating from it. But that is a matter that criminal prosecuting authorities would have to deal with at an appropriate time.
But do you acknowledge the sense of anger on the part of the public that something like criminal sanction is more important because one can simply build into your cost structure fines?
That's right, Eusebius, and I think this is partly why the South African Parliament criminalised cartel conduct. I think it was in response largely to the historic investigations we've done on bread and other things. So I think it's right that, and I mean, people are calling for more punishment, and I hear that. I have to work with the law that applied at
sure,
the time.
Sure, that makes sense.
And I think, as I said, it's not. People should not say there will be no criminal charges here. We can't say that because as the conduct itself, at least to me as a lawyer, looks like could trigger all sorts of other offences in common law in South Africa.
What happens to the fines that you do get? Say, for example, the 69 million. Who gets that, Nkandla?
it goes to the National Revenue Fund.
So what happens to the little person that may have been affected? Is it just practically impossible to trace that person and give them 2 cents?
Well, any person who gets affected by an unlawful either collusion or even abuse of dominance, they can claim. That's why in the U.S. there is a class action against banks from those who feel that they were affected. So the punishment that the commission meets on them doesn't take away. In fact, strengthens the right of those who suffer damages to claim for damages.
Okay, and then last question, Tim, because we're running out of time, so just for 20 seconds, because I want to put one more question to the other guests as well. Why did Citibank settle with you guys? Did you need one of the baddies to settle so that you can get information about the bigger baddies?
Admittedly, Eusebius is a complex case, and we did need more witnesses and evidence, and that helps strengthen that that case.
Stuart, I'm going to give you a minute here. Rob and I were gossiping about a central question here in terms of the moral crisis of this sector and the importance of banks being held accountable, particularly when we're often very hard on looting, and rightly so, that happens within the state. Is there a bigger crisis here for the sector?
I think the answers are complex, but let me say this. The specific conduct at work here was involved international markets, involved counterparties around the world. And in a way, this was a channel that allowed for a certain culture in global banking to be imported into South African bank activity. So we've spoken about the cases in the US and the UK of major fines dished out to banks there for this kind of currency manipulation. Now, it's the only example where South African banks have found themselves involved and embroiled. We haven't had, for instance, an equivalent of the LIBOR scandal, and we certainly haven't had anything like the mis-selling of mortgage-backed securities and so on that were all part of the financial crisis. On the whole, our banks have behaved remarkably well. This is the first real case of this. Now, that doesn't detract from the fact that this is serious. What these guys did was unacceptable, and it should be prosecuted severely. But we must also remember the context and keep things in perspective. This is a case involving traders at quite a low level in a bank who are communicating with each other to basically try and fix them to earn themselves bigger bonuses. It doesn't indicate a systemic rot or a systemic immoral problem across our banking system.
10 seconds, Rob. Do you agree?
I do agree. I think that the bigger issue, though, is whether the bank's compliance system should not have picked this up and what this says about executive management at these banks. So, that you know, it's CEOs and executive might not have been involved, but should they not have picked this up? So I think that's something that will have to be delved into.
Rob, you've been great. Thanks for coming to the studio. Stuart, thank you as always for your insights. We really should have them more often on non-specialist programs. Thanks for coming on all the way from London. And Tembin Corsi, thank you so much for making time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.